When you pull up to the Museum of Minerals and Crystals in Dodgeville, Wisconsin, the first thing you notice is how simple the building is. No adornment implying anything special inside. It has a simple listing of hours and a lit open sign. Inside, a wood-paneled room leads either to a gift shop on the right, where you can buy tickets, or the museum proper on the left, which has a small velvet rope which the old man behind the desk will walk over, undo, and then give you a few short introductory remarks about the building before letting you wander around, looking at different crystals, rocks, minerals, and artwork for as long as you like or until closing, whichever comes first. Lacking too much detail about their acquisition, these rocks rely on their own innate beauty to represent the pleasure you'll get walking among them. While the time is unlimited, within about 15 minutes you'll have seen everything, and you'll go back to your car driving away. Which makes it, in its simplicity, a wonderful and appropriate aperitif from the horrifying, cacophonous, literal carousel of nightmares from the roadside attraction down the street, the House on the Rock. This is Jason Scott Talks His Way Out of It, a podcast about technology, history, and getting myself out of debt. Thanks to Daniel Boyd, Eric Vitello, and the hundreds of other supporters on Patreon and elsewhere who have been supporting me and helping me get out of debt. The House on the Rock is a roadside attraction in the same way that the Grand Canyon is a hole in the ground. Now existing for decades, the House on the Rock is both legendary and obscure. But I had read about the existence 30 years ago, in my teens, when a review of it put together in one page what sounded like an impossible, fantastic place filled with collections of collections of collections, and providing it all in a soundscape of music and noise and fear that even the staff would experience as nightmares in their first few weeks of working there. It definitely sounded like a place that I would want to experience, to walk through, and that, while even as a teenager I didn't have anything close to a large collection of anything, would be an inspiration to me that one person would put together such an amazing place. When I found during a vacation that I would be going to Madison, Wisconsin, and that Madison was just a short drive away from this mythical house, I made sure to put time aside to visit it. And here's where things start to cascade. Roadside attractions work best with mystery. They need you to lack major details about what they are, what they do, where they came from, and what you're going to find when you get there. In fact, they're best done when they're serendipitous, something you wander into, drive by, pull around, go into, unsure of what you're seeing and being promised the world before you walk in to darkness, to surprise, to, in more cases than not, disappointment. The signs that lead you to these attractive cul-de-sacs can promise you that it's just a few more miles before you find yourself in this world you would never want to miss. And even if when you get there, it's a simple, small display along with a lot of merchandise that will lure others in, you feel you've gone on an adventure of discovery. In the modern era, that is functionally impossible. Everything has been researched, can be looked up, can have photographs and walkthroughs and reviews and stars given. If people know the destination, they can use their phones and have the equivalent of a private investigator's report within seconds and know exactly what they're going to find. To that end, I'll tell you that the House on the Rock definitely experiences the problem of having its true story available at the same time as its false one. While I'm usually a stickler for the truth, the story of the House on the Rock stands separate from its truth. the facade of the legend compared to the actual truth has been crumbling for quite some time. Books have been written, reports have been done. It's not hard to pick apart the story of how the House on the Rock came to be. None of this, however, diminishes the experience. Even if you're crammed with information, like a student studying for finals as you walk up to the House on the Rock, it still has plenty to make you surprised. The legend of the House on the Rock is that a reclusive artist built a strange, unusual dwelling at the top of a small mound of rocks out in a distant part of Wisconsin. And with control of a ladder that allowed access to this house, a steady stream of curious onlookers began stopping by until, unable to take it anymore, he started charging admission, and in doing so, suddenly found himself with the means to build an entire complex of buildings and walkways, which then filled itself with collection after collection that he would purchase from all over the world. Until now, years after Alex Jordan has passed away, onlookers come by the thousands to pay admission and walk through room after room of impossible-to-describe wonders acquired by this gentle, unusual, and in many ways inscrutable figure. That's a pretty good legend, as legends go. The ingredients of this soup are delicious and timeless, a unique spirit, and wondrous dreams. And it's a legend that falls apart almost instantly with the use of the weapon of the World Wide Web and all of its interconnected essays and first-person accounts of what the House on the Rock is. It would be unbecoming and dull for me to go into everywhere the legend is not true. But at the very least, I would say it is absolutely not the work of a single person, and it never has been. The original house is the work of a crew hired by this artist, people who were day laborers or even engineers brought in to consult. The house is absolutely a low-slung series of rooms carpeted on the ceiling, feeling more like a ship with staircases every which way, doors of variant size, and views out into the forest through stained glass windows and colored skylights, providing it with the feeling of a party pad, a madman's laboratory, a small and definitive museum of artwork and statues, which, frankly, may have been added many years later as he moved out of the house and began working on the rest of what this attraction consists of. One part of the story that definitely lingers through all of the literature and which definitely has the ring of truth is that as crowds began to come, they were charged admission. And using the money from that admission, there were more buildings built into the complex. First, a gatehouse with much of the same design as the house itself, along with a Japanese garden, sidewalks, and decks over the woods. From that seed of oddity came another 30 years of building, expanding, and collecting, which is what I walked into. Each of the buildings at the House on the Rock have a theme, but the themes are general: nostalgia, music, Dante's Inferno, a 50s diner, somebody's garage, a camera store, and they're all connected through a winding maze of hallways and ramps that are both intentional and disturbing that they were so intentional. There are music machines everywhere, some the size of a jukebox, others taking up entire rooms, which you can activate by using tokens that you buy at various stations around the museum. The buildings, therefore, echo with the sound of brass and piano and striking metal as you walk through dark passages, many of them barely light enough to find out which direction you should go in. It can take 3 or 4 hours to go through all of the buildings. Even at a relatively brisk pace, you can't understand how big it is because you are constantly making turns, going up and down ramps, and finding yourself in front of displays that completely lack sense. A fake dentist's office filled with all sorts of medicines taken from the last 100 years. A room with nothing but hundreds of dolls. Another one with nothing but instruments. Yet another hallway, which you only find if you take a wrong turn, that has nothing but vases in the shape of women's heads. It's utterly impossible to figure out what is new, what is old, and what has been crafted by the many people hired by the artist over the years to add variety and spice to what was already there. To say that it all culminates in something would be a lie, but there are multiple chambers, I hesitate to call them rooms, that indicate which direction this artist was moving. One of the last constructed rooms has a diorama with a whale being attacked by a squid, except the model of the whale is easily 4 stories high, and the squid is as large as a bus. All of it surrounded by thousands, probably tens of thousands, of mementos and pieces of marine history, everything from models of ships to parts and tools that would be used by sailors, along with posters and paintings and representations of the sea. None of it with explanations of where it came from or its historical significance. Which is good, because if anything has been indicated by outside reports, half of this museum is completely fabricated, drawn from workshops that were on site and staffed by hired artists who spent years adding to every display and every dreamed room. There's another chamber filled with a carousel. But not just a carousel of hundreds of creatures, none of them carousel horses, twisted bodies and malformed animals constructed into hybrids of machinery and legend and fantasy, all spinning in real time, never to be ridden, but instead filling the room, a room with itself covered in all sorts of musical instruments and bizarre steam engines, constantly making a carousel noise, never stopping, as long as you're there, without rest or any meaning, only with a few laconic staff members making sure that nobody does the impulsive thing to run among a carousel billed as the largest in the world and containing 80 chandeliers rising over these figures. When the madness of the carousel is too much for you, you walk through an open mouth of a devil to go into a reimagining of Dante's Inferno, portrayed with organs and smaller carousels of dolls along with steam engines that looked like they were the size of tractor trailers, all interlocking and moving, while all of these ramps going up and down stories have religious figures and statues by the hundreds looking down at you as you stumble. The only theme is duplicity. If you see one mask, you're going to see 50. If you see one small clown figurine, there's going to be 1,000. There's hundreds of dollhouses, dozens of jukeboxes, literal piles of artwork and models and adorned pieces of the world that either imply or probably are hundreds of years old. Naturally, walking through this, I tried to quantify what I was looking at, tried to look up whether something existed, whether the circus mentioned on the side of a poster ever happened, or when a certain ship portrayed in a model ever actually sailed. And within a short time, I realized that if I didn't stop doing it, I could spend the rest of the day in there, 12 hours before they found me and pulled me out of there, because it never ended. Everything about the House on the Rock is beyond the pale. It is literally a monument to never saying enough. It is both an enshrinement and a warning of the years, the decades of collecting I've done digitally. It's an expression of what I'm doing with endless file folders, constant zip files, and terabytes a day of traffic, much of it without context or meaning, meant to be, in its own way, something for another day, for an undefined and fuzzy future. When Alex Jordan died, he had sold the museum to a business partner who continues to expand out, although he has promised not to modify the original buildings. There is a welcome center that is beautiful and airy and designed to be able to handle the crowds coming in by bus to walk through the museum. His pledge to leave the original buildings as they are comes at a price. The house on the rock is unquestionably decaying. Many of the walkways outside are carpets, moldy and rotting. The musical machinery only half works. In many cases, they've put speakers behind them to imitate what the machine used to do. There's scuffs, there's rips. While there is no obvious layer of dust on everything, there is a sense that the things themselves are not entirely long for the world. The day will come when the house on the rock will be a shadow of what it once was, when too many things have been pulled out for repairs or stored away because they no longer can stand on their own. Decay is a natural thing when a collection was designed with no long-term goals built into it. But for the moment, for this brief, evocative moment, if you're somebody who wishes to see something truly unique, unparalleled in its oddity, implementation of randomness, and container upon container of worlds within, I can give no higher recommendation than for you to find the excuse to come to Spring Green, Wisconsin, and experience the House on the Rock. This is Jason Scott Talks His Way Out of It. Thanks to James Bakoyanu, Mark Pilgrim, Peter Healy, Emilio Oliveira, Ernie Hershey, Michael Rubin, Matt Reynolds, Sean Kelly, Manxalot, John Sturm, and Anonymous, along with the hundreds of other supporters on Patreon and elsewhere, who have been supporting me and helping me get out of debt. There's one other bonus aspect, one more gift the House on the Rock gives you that not everybody discusses. A few days or a few weeks later, your brain, trying to process the experience, will give you one of the more unique, twisted, out-of-control dreams you will probably experience in your lifetime. Mine involved a turn-of-the-century Russian palace, a cast of what seemed like 1,000 people, and the most dishware and tables and chairs and amusement park rides I've ever seen. If you get a chance to go, let me know how your dreams went.